Today is October 28th, 2009. We are at the Amelia Island Museum of History, Museum of Fernandina Beach, 233 South 3rd Street in Florida 32034. The following interview is being conducted as part of the Amelia Island Museum of History's Veteran History Project in partnership with the Library of Congress. We are interviewing Edward George Redden, who was born July 8th, 1937, in Waterbury, Connecticut. My name is Frank Reitinger, and I will interview the subject on behalf of the Amelia Island Museum of History. Assisting me is Don Hill, who will operate the recording equipment. I will now begin the interview. Okay, just start us off and run with it.
Okay, I entered the Naval Academy in June of 1955. I had a direct appointment to the Academy from my local congressman in Connecticut. I also had an appointment to the first class at the Air Force Academy. But being a somewhat new organization at the time, I opted for the Naval Academy. I graduated with the class of 1959 in June of 1959. Following graduation, I was detailed back to the Academy, to the Navigation Department, to help indoctrinate the incoming class. Following that tour at the Academy, I entered flight training in Pensacola, Florida, went through pre-flight training, into basic training flying the T-34, into intermediate training flying the T-28 and care qual in the T-28 before going on to advanced training. In the advanced training, I was with a squadron, a training squadron at NAS New Iberia, Louisiana, flying S-2s. Following the completion of training, I was assigned to VS-31 flying S-2s out of Naval Air Station Quonset Point, Rhode Island, and our squadron and the air wing were based on the USS Wasp, homeported in Boston. One of the significant events during that tour of duty is the squadron and the carrier participated in the blockade of Cuba during the Cuban missile crisis, and subsequent deployments included deployments to Northern Europe and to the Mediterranean. Following that tour of duty, I was assigned to the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, California, where I earned a Master of Science degree in management. Upon the completion of the school, I received orders to the Naval Ordnance Unit in Key West, Florida. This was an organization that supported the pre-production test of underwater weapon systems and sound systems, and we worked for, at the time, the Bureau of Ordnance. One of the most significant events that occurred down there during this period of time is we were involved in the pre-production support of the Mark 48 torpedo, which as of this date, and of course many updated forms, is still, I think, the principal weapon of the submarine force. Following that tour in Key West, I transitioned to jet aircraft. I went to the Navy's Jet Transition Unit in Kingsville, Florida, where I flew F-9F Cougars and was assigned, following that, a set of orders into the A-6 community. I flew the A-6 at the replacement air wing at Oceana Naval Air Station in Virginia Beach and subsequently was assigned to Attack Squadron 65. The first deployment with Attack Squadron 65 was, in fact, with an air wing stationed aboard USS Kitty Hawk out of San Diego. It was during that deployment, that was a deployment made to Vietnam. Now, the reason we deployed on Kitty Hawk was that the A-6 was a relatively new aircraft in the fleet at the time, and there were not sufficient squadrons located on the West Coast to pick up the load with the West Coast carriers. So during that period of time, all East Coast A-6 squadrons, rather than deploying to the Mediterranean, were in fact deploying to Vietnam, either with East Coast or West Coast carriers. Mm-hmm. So we deployed right after Christmas of 1968. We arrived in the Philippines in January of 69, and after a short port visit, proceeded to Yankee Station off of Vietnam. Now, there was another carrier on station with us, but it was a smaller class carrier, and they were not equipped with A-6 aircraft. So for the entire period of time we were over there, we were in this particular situation. So the Kitty Hawk and its A-6s were essentially flying night the entire time we were over there. We would get a day or two to warm up. The carrier landings went anytime we came out of port, but then we went to a night schedule and flew roughly 40 days on station all during night missions. The only thing that broke up the routine of the deployment was that during the deployment there was an incident in North Korea. It seems to me it was a shoot down of a reconnaissance plane, which caused the entire task force to redeploy from Vietnam waters up toward Korea, and we operated up there for a period of time off of Okinawa, Japan, and up toward Korea. And when that particular incident calmed down, we again returned back to Yankee Station. That was toward the end of our deployment, which ran until August of 69, when we returned to the States, got back to the States in September of 69. Now, during our time in Vietnam, we were primarily involved with the interdiction of supplies and troops coming from North Vietnam into the South, down the Ho Chi Minh Trail through Laos and Cambodia. The one significant event, at least as far as I was personally concerned, involved a strike. I just mentioned all of our flying was done at night. This particular strike was at the end of the cycle, so it turned out, in fact, the strike was made during daylight hours in the early morning. But we were making a strike against a transshipment point out of Vietnam up in the Bang Krai Pass area in eastern Laos. And my wingman and I, on the strike, it was quite a distance from the ship. There were just us two A-6s because we were the only aircraft in the wing that had the legs to be able to get to the target and back within the cycle, carrier's launch and recovery cycle. And because we were pressed for time, we were restricted for some reason, I'm still to this day not sure why it occurred, we were restricted to a particular run-in cone to the target. Because of the distance, I broke my wingman off first to make his run on the target, and I continued a little farther up to come in on a different angle from in the cone into the target. It was an extremely hazy day. We never did get a visual sighting of the target, but we obviously had it on our weapon systems, on the radars, and so forth. And during this run, I was hit by anti-aircraft fire, which I am convinced to this day was aimed at my wingman, because we never had any radar signals indicating it was being directed in any other manner except at sound, because it was so hazy we couldn't see the ground. I'm sure they couldn't see us. They were shooting at sound. And I'm sure they were shooting at him, and I came in behind him and flew into it. Which caused us to lose the aircraft, and my bombardier and I ejected. Now, fortunately, we were far enough north where we were within approximately 90 miles of an Air Force base in Thailand, and at this base were located search and rescue people. So they, needless to say, received our emergency calls, and in fact, my wingman remained overhead the target area to coordinate the recovery. And the Air Force launched SPADs or ADs out to suppress the fire of the people on the ground to neutralize the area when the helos arrived. And the helos did arrive, checked in with us, and of course we were in contact with them, my bombardier and I. I never saw him on the ground. We were in two different locations. It was a very steeply sloped, heavily wooded area. So we never did see each other until after the pickup. But the helicopters came in, and the ADs were, in fact, flying right down below us on this hillside, suppressing the fire of the guns down below us. And the helicopters checked in with us, and we said, okay, the ADs are going to make one final run to lay a smoke screen so we can come up over the ridge and come in and pick you up. And the ADs did that, and the smoke was laid down in this valley. The helicopters came up over the ridge, and they immediately had my position, and they hovered and lowered the rescue cable with the rescue device at the end of the cable. Now, in the Navy, we were always taught in training, if this ever occurred to you, the Navy, when they lowered this cable, at the end of the cable was a rescue device, but attached to it was a J-hook. And all jet aviators wore a torso harness with a D-ring on it. And the first thing they told you is snap that D-ring onto that J-hook, and the helicopter is not going to go anywhere without you. So the first thing I did was to go to snap my D-ring onto that J-hook. But the Air Force didn't have a J-hook on my rigs. So I started to unbuckle the paddle seat that they were using to get us out. And as I started to do this, the helicopter, the smoke started to come up the ridge line, and the helicopter started to depart. And I was not on a rig. So I just grabbed hold of the cable, and I got to ride through the trees. Eventually they got me up into the helicopter, but it was just a handhold to get me up there. They returned us to Karat, and as they lowered the ramp to take us off the helicopter, there standing to greet us was my air wing commander and the task force commander. The air wing commander and the admiral were right there, and I subsequently found out they were there for a meeting. They weren't there to welcome us home by any stretch of imagination. But fortunately for us, we were transferred from the helicopter immediately to a C-130 and flown down to an Air Force hospital in Karat, Thailand. So I'm sure the Air Wing Commander and the Admiral got to pay a very hefty bar bill to the people who plucked us out of the woods that day. Mm-hmm. So we spent some time at Karat and were transferred back to Air Force Hospital at Clark Air Force Base in the Philippines. My bombardier's injuries sustained during all of this were not so severe that he couldn't go back to the carrier. However, I wound up with a broken foot and a banged up leg, and they sent me back to the States because there was no way I'd be able to maneuver around an aircraft carrier and crutches and so forth. So following the period of recovery, I was given a couple of flights, refresher flights, and replacement air group and sent back to the carrier. And I joined them in the waters up off of Japan, where they had gone because of this Korean incident, and returned for one final line period back into Vietnam, and we returned to the States. Now, the next time the squadron deployed, we were on USS Independence and deployed to the Mediterranean. The only significant event that occurred during that period of time, that when we were in the Eastern Med, well, we weren't in the Eastern Med when it occurred, but one of the Arab groups hijacked an Israeli airliner and parked it out in the middle of the desert, and it was quite a bit to do about what we were going to do about that. So the Independence was moved to the Eastern Mediterranean. We stayed on station for about 30 days, just watching the situation, if you will. It was interesting. We had the A-7 squadrons that were usually in our wing were being upgraded to the newer models. So during this deployment, we had a Marine A-4 squadron aboard. And we were briefed by them on how to attack tanks and that sort of thing in case that ever occurred. And one of the humorous things, this young Marine, his first time as a carrier aviator, was briefing us on this, and somebody asked the question, how do you distinguish between Israeli tanks and the Arab tanks? And he informed us that we could immediately determine the difference because they had different treads on the tanks. Now, I can't imagine how he figured we had a rolling point at 10,000 feet we were going to be able to determine which tank treads were which, but in any event. We were relieved on station by USS Saratoga at the time, returned to port in Athens, and shortly thereafter, I detached from the ship and returned to the States. The next tour was with the Air Test and Evaluation Development Squadron 5, Detachment Oceana. I spent about 3.5 years there. Test and Evaluation Squadron 5 was charged with operational test and evaluation of attack aircraft and aircraft weapon systems. The Oceana detachment was a permanent detachment that dealt only with the A-6 aircraft. Mm. It, being a new aircraft and with, at the time, a very advanced avionics system and weapon systems, the home squadron is based at China Lake, California. They didn't have the capability out there to maintain the system, so the detachment was established, was set up in Oceana, where all of the A-6s, most of the A-6s at the time were based. During that particular period of time, we did a lot of work with the test of laser-guided weapons, both missiles and bombs. And in fact, one of the aircraft that we were used in the testing of these weapons was, we transferred to one of the deploying squadrons headed out to Vietnam toward the end of the war, and in fact, the can't remember the name of the bridge. That's a big bridge.
Paul
in Vietnam, North Vietnam.
Yeah, Paul Dornier.
No, what's the name of the bridge? It was bombed the whole war. It never came down.
It wasn't the Paul.
No. We need this.
Well, we can live without it, but that's the only one I remember. I don't know where that was. I remember they bombed and bombed and bombed.
I'll bring it up as I can't remember the name. Go ahead, you run again. I can't think of the name. I'll just use it.
Come on. Was that the bridge out of Hanoi?
Yeah.
It was way up north.
It was north, yeah. I have too.
I wasn't there.
Don't worry about it. Just say the bridge. The big bridge north of Hanoi.
There you go. What north of Hanoi is that? Go ahead.
Or wherever.
Okay, to continue, this particular aircraft then deployed, and there was an infamous bridge in North Vietnam that had been bombed since the beginning of the war, and nothing can bring it down, but it eventually came down as a result of being struck by these. Finally, we had these laser-guided weapons that we could put on the bridge and brought that particular bridge down. So following that tour in VX-5, Dead Oceana, I was relieved as the officer in charge, and in fact, the gentleman who relieved me wound up closing the detachment down and moved to China Lake because they were finally able to support the aircraft out there. Following that tour, I was assigned to the staff of the commander of the 2nd Fleet, where I was the air operations and strike officer. When deployed, obviously, we had triple hat, actually. We were Striking Fleet Atlantic, which was the NATO striking fleet, and we were also Commander Joint Task Force 122, which included U.S. assets, Air Force and Army assets, as well as Marines. Under our NATO hat, we made a number of cruises to Northern Europe. Probably the most significant event that occurred during that particular tour of duty was our participation. In fact, I was involved with the development of the op order for the International Naval Review that was held in New York City as part of the bicentennial celebration in 1976. And the fleet commander at the time was a fellow most of us know now, Stansfield Turner.
Huh.
Following that tour, I was assigned as the executive officer and then commanding officer of an advanced jet training squadron in Beeville, Texas, flying the A-4 Skyhawk. And from there, I was assigned as the air officer on USS Saratoga, homeported in Mayport, Florida. I got to tell you one story that probably shouldn't be on the tape. Our last deployment out of the Med, our last cruise in Saratoga. Saratoga did not get a workup before it went because they knew it couldn't pass it, but they had to get the carrier to the Med. Coming out of Athens, our last port call, we had a 10-day underway period, and we were steaming home from there. First launch in the morning went out. Getting on that final deployment of Saratoga on the way back to Mayport, and it was the final deployment for Saratoga for a number of years because following its arrival in Mayport, it proceeded to Philadelphia Naval Shipyard to enter what they called a SLEP program, which is a Surface Life Extension Program, which was a multi-year total overhaul of the ship. But coming back from the Mediterranean, the ship participated in what was a relatively new event at the time called a Tiger Cruise. Were male relatives, dads, granddads, and sons above a certain age could make the return back to the States in the ship. So the Tigers were flown into Spain and boarded Saratoga and rode back to Mayport. And during the return, they got to participate in various exercises and were shepherded around by various divisions on the ship. Generally, the divisions are squadrons of their sponsor, and get to see life at sea as it occurred on a daily basis. And I think that was a very popular program, and I suspect it's still used to some extent. So following the return up to Philadelphia for an overhaul, and I remained aboard the ship for approximately 6 months. And to this time, I'm not sure why the air officer had to go into overhaul with the ship, but it turned out to be beneficial to the crew because the ship's COD, or logistics aircraft, stayed with the ship, and I was able to load it up with the sailors who still had families here every weekend and flying back to Mayport. Huh. So that was one of the benefits that was derived from keeping the COD aboard the carrier during the overhaul period. I obviously did not see the entire overhaul period. Like I say, I was there for about 6 months, and then I was transferred to Newport, Rhode Island, to the Naval Education and Training Center, where I was the director for training for approximately 5 years. And that, in layman's term, was I was essentially the superintendent of schools for the Navy in Newport. And at the number of schools varied over the years. There were 7 or 8 schools at any given time, including the officer candidate school, the officer candidate preparatory school, the senior enlisted academy, the chaplain school, the Naval Academy prep school, instructor training school, and Naval Institute. And if I've missed any, it's because of the intervening years of kind of a race part of it. I just mentioned one of the schools that I was responsible for was the Naval Academy Prep School. Now, at the end of 5 years up there, the director of the Naval Academy Prep School was retiring, and I had 3 years to go until retirement. And the Navy saw fit, and the Naval Academy saw fit, since I was involved with the management of that school for 5 previous years, that I would relieve this individual as the director of the school. So I spent my last 3 years in the Navy as the director of the Naval Academy Prep School, and I retired out of that position.
How did that work? Who came to that school? Who were the students?
Well, most people don't realize the Naval Academy Prep School is in fact the third oldest school in the Navy. It's only predated by the Naval Academy itself and the Naval War College. And the purpose of the prep school, it spent most of its time located at the Naval Station in Bainbridge, Maryland. There was a period of time during the Civil War when it was relocated to Newport, Rhode Island, for obvious reasons. But when the Naval Station at Bainbridge was shut down, and I don't remember when that happened, probably the late 60s, early 70s, they moved the school up to Newport, where it was then homeported. In fact, it is still located in Newport. Now, the purpose of the school was to provide an opportunity for fleet sailors and Marines coming into the Naval Academy to get a year of refresher in academics. because most of them obviously had been out of high school for a certain number of years. So it gave them a chance to get boned up so they could compete successfully at the Naval Academy. And over the years, it's still the purpose of the Naval Academy, but also is used as a primary minority accession point to the Naval Academy. And during my eight-year association with the Academy, statistics showed over that period of time that, as a matter of fact, the success rate at the Naval Academy was higher for the Naval Academy prep school graduate than it was for the direct entry student. So it was a very successful program and did a lot of very good things for very deserving people.
What was your graduation rate at the prep school of these enlisted guys that came through? Did most of them make it through the prep school, or did they?
Yeah, the majority of them would make it through the prep school.
And then they were automatically given a slot at the Academy?
Yeah, there are a certain number of slots. Secretary of the Navy appointments are set aside for fleet sailors and Marines. In other words, they didn't necessarily receive a congressional appointment. Mm-hmm. We always encouraged them to do that, which would open up another secretary slot for some other sailor or Marine if they could, in fact, go out and get an appointment from their political representative.
How many a year from the prep school would go to the Academy, roughly?
Oh, a couple hundred.
Really? Wow.
Yeah.
100.
A couple hundred, thereabouts.
And these were all enlisted men from the Navy and the Marines that took some tests to qualify to go to the
They're high performers.
High performers.
Now, we did, in fact, have some people, like I say, for one reason or another, the Academy was looking at these people. I'll give you an example. You may have a young man or woman with a very, very good record out of high school, and it's a very competitive process to get into the Naval Academy, obviously. And there's something in that record that they want to take a look at. Again, you know, let's clear this up. So they sent them to the prep school for a year before going down there. Now, that person coming out of high school would have to enlist in the Navy to come to the prep school. So that was a sailor, theoretically.
How many people were in a class?
Oh, I'm trying to think. There was about 300. Now, I told you the success rate was pretty good, and it was, because in that 300 were a number of Coast Guard candidates. Mm. So the Coast Guard started using the Navy prep school to prepare their people to go to the Coast Guard Academy. So I don't recall the exact breakout of how many Coast Guards and how many Navy Marine.
And those that enlisted.
You had to enlist to get in the school.
At the prep school, if they bilged out, they went to the fleet. Did they not?
No, they did not.
They got released?
They were released from the contract.
I got you.
Now, if they went to the Naval Academy,
That's
a different issue. Exactly. That's handled by the Naval Academy on a case-by-case basis.
Yeah, what happens to guys that wash out of the Naval Academy, generally speaking?
They're probably released from there. Now, unless, again, if it's one of the fleet sailors and Marines, are going back to the Fleet Marine Force or back to sea, or back to the Navy Forces. But a civilian is usually allowed to go.
What was your attrition rate at the Naval Academy from what you started with till what you ended up with 4 years later? Was it pretty notable? Or?
It seems to me we started with about 12 or 1,300, and we graduated about 800.
Wow. Tell us about your summer cruises. I think that's interesting.
Summer cruises at the Naval Academy?
Yeah.
As a midshipman?
Every year you did something different every summer?
Yeah. At the end of the first year, you cruised on one of the fleet ships. In my case, I was assigned to a battleship. It was USS Iowa. And we made a cruise to Northern Europe. Stopped in England on the way back, and then we were going to make a stop in Cuba before returning to Annapolis. But the stop in Cuba wound up a stop in Cuba at Guantanamo Bay because there was a fellow by the name of Castro who was in the process of stirring things up down there. The next summer period was split into two sections. Part of it was an amphibious training period where you work with the Navy amphibs and Marines and most of that was conducted at Naval Amphibious Base, Little Creek. And the other portion of the summer was aviation training, which was spent at Pensacola, where you got to fly in the various aircraft that people would fly around in. And then the last year was again a cruise, and I was assigned to a destroyer which deployed to the Mediterranean.
So how did they decide, or you decide, that you were going to get in aviation? How was that done in coming out of the Naval Academy?
Well, it's much restricted today because of the needs of the Navy. When I graduated, for instance, I wanted to go in Navy Air, the only requirement was that you were physically qualified to go.
But they didn't take everybody that applied because they'd have too many, would they?
Well, if you were physically qualified, there was no reason not to.
Oh, really?
No, there weren't too many then.
Oh.
In fact, as I mentioned, my first assignment after I graduated was to stay right there at the Naval Academy, because in that detail that they kept there after commissioning were 99% aviators, because there was no room in the flight training program because of all the colleges, ROTCs and so forth, were graduating, and it just blocked the training program.
So they just gave you something to do waiting your slot.
So it gave us something to do, and it helped the Naval Academy because of the influx of people, and there were no upper class in numbers there to help train, so we stayed to train. And in fact, by the time you got your wings just about as quick as the guys who went down there initially, because their progress through the pipe was so slow because of the numbers. Yeah, numbers were not a problem, as I recall, back then.
Yeah, I interviewed one guy whose son stayed on at the academy waiting his slot, and he was instructing in the sailboats. He was a sailing instructor.
Yeah, the same thing I do. In the navigation department, you taught him seamanship and navigation, how to sail.
Did you get involved with sailboats at all?
Yeah, how to drive the YPs, the R Patrol craft around, things like that.
Did you take any trips with the sailboats?
No, they were just in the Severn River area.
Okay.
No.
Because I've seen some in New York Harbor with
those are midshipmen who have have a little experience.
Yeah, yeah. Right. Anything else that you want to talk about?
No, how we have the benefit of his presence here.
Yep. Okay, so then you got out of the Navy after 30 years as a captain.
Mm-hmm.
And then what got you here to Amelia Island?
Oh, okay, I retired in the Newport, Rhode Island area. My wife is originally from Newport, and we built a home up there that we were going to live in forever. But we decided we needed to do something not to pay the Rhode Island taxes, which at that time were running about 33% of federal tax. Mm. And we would always, from our days in Newport, we'd always enjoyed Amelia Island. So we came back down here and built a home here. And we intended to use it for 6 days or 6 months and a day for tax purposes. And after doing that for 1 year, we decided, why in the world do we want to go back up to Rhode Island? We would just stay so much busier here in the island than we ever would have done up there. So here we are.
Okay, I'm going to embarrass you now. Tell us about your awards and medals: Purple Heart, Air Medal, etc. The Purple Heart was from the ejection?
Yeah, that was from the shoot down.
Okay. And the Air Medals?
Air Medals was Strike Flight Air Medals for the Vietnam business.
You flew so many missions, then
so many missions, you were awarded an Air Medal.
Mm-hmm.
If you were under fire during that period of time, you got extra credit for that sort of thing. And a Meritorious Service Medal and a Navy Commendation Medal.
What were you doing when you got the Commendation Medal? Did you get that?
That was part of the Second Fleet thing for development of the outboard for the International Naval Review.
Oh, cool. Yeah. I bet that was interesting working on that New York celebration here in 1970.
Well, it was for most of the guys. In fact, about 2 months before the actual event occurred, the planning group that I was a part of on the staff was, in fact, moved to the World Trade Center offices. Yeah, well, this years before. But just about the time they moved, I was detached. So like most people, I got to watch the fruits of my labor on television. I was not physically there.
Did you get involved in the planning? Or were you
yeah,
detached?
Yeah, I was involved.
Well, talk about that a little bit. I bet that's interesting.
Well, I was involved in preparing the op order for it. There were some problems. For instance, the charts showing the Hudson River that hadn't been dredged in years and years and years, didn't have as much water there as people thought, so that had to be addressed. One of the politically sensitive issues, we were going to line the ships alphabetically by country, which then caused the problem between the Egyptians and the Israelis. But these are, you know, nitpick sort of things. The flagship, I forgot which flagship we were on at the time, but in fact it wasn't used as part of the ceremony because they put the Forrestal was the flagship for it, so the Second Fleet Commander, in fact, moved the flag aboard the Forrestal. And they couldn't have used the cruiser that we were on because the river wasn't deep enough, so they took one of the new, smaller cruisers as the reviewing ship for the International Naval Review, which the layman wouldn't recognize that wasn't really the big cruiser that the Admiral usually rode on.
How about the flying activities? Talk about that a little bit.
With the International Naval Review?
Yeah.
I didn't have a part in that.
Didn't they?
I don't remember that.
All
I remember was the gun ship. Salutes and the passing of the flagship by the ships at anchor.
Yeah.
I don't remember.
It's pretty impressive.
Whether it was any air activity.
Is there anything else you want to talk about?
I don't think so.
Well, we've only gone 55 minutes or so. Okay. This concludes the interview with Ed Redden, and we want to thank him for sharing his recollections and for our service to the country. Thank you very much.